Good afternoon. It's good to be back with you. I'm always so thankful for this opportunity to stand before you and to offer these thoughts on the Word of God, to share with you God's holy text. And tonight we're continuing our discussion of the book of Revelation as revealed to the Apostle John, trying to make application where necessary in our own lives and learning about the first century church. This week we are continuing to look at the latter chapters of this great book. Last week we were together. We looked at chapters 15 and 16. And so what we've been looking at here is in chapter 4, we know John receives his vision of heaven, of the throne room of heaven. And as we continue in the book, we see how God revealed to the first century saints the things they would have to suffer and how they would have to stay true to their faith. And then as we continue to look, God then turns his attention to the nation of people who have been persecuting his people, and how that he will bring vengeance upon those who persecute his saints. And as we've looked, God has talked about how he will pour out his bowls of wrath upon these people. Well, we're continuing in that same context and idea as we get into chapter 17 tonight. And so for just a little bit, I would like to discuss the things we see here in John's revealing of God's truth to the first century Christians. And as we begin to look at chapter 17, the first thing I want us to notice in chapter 17 itself, he deals with the nature of what we will call Babylon. And we're going to get more into that as we go. But he will phrase the focus of attention here on this great harlot he will later call Babylon the Great. And we're going to look at maybe why he uses that phrase as we continue here. But let's begin by looking at the nature of Babylon, of this great harlot. And the first thing we notice begins in verse 1 and verse 2 of chapter 17. He writes, "Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and talked with me, saying to me, 'Come, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication.'" So he has received a series of visions, and here he receives another vision, this time from one of the seven angels who poured out the bowls. He doesn't tell us which one, we don't know that, but we do know that one of them comes and then reveals this vision to him. And the vision he sees is one of a great harlot, a great prostitute, who is sitting upon many waters. And then he talks about the fornication she's committed with the inhabitants of the earth, and how she has made them drunk. She has, in other words, had a great influence, confusing their vision and their thinking. This entity that he's talking about here is one in which has great influence, one in which rules over the world. In verse 15, he explains a little bit about what he's talking about when he writes, "Then he said, the angel said to me, John, 'The waters which you saw where the harlot sits are peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues.'" So he defines for us what it means here when it says she sits on many waters. In other words, she has great influence over many people, over nations of the day. This entity is a ruling force in the world. And we'll come back to Genesis 11 and verse 9 in just a moment, but I want to go on to the next thing here we see. Is as we continue reading in verse 3, we notice the excess of which this harlot adorns herself. Notice in verse 3, he says, "So he, the angel, carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness." And so now he's seeing another vision now of a wilderness. "And I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of names of blasphemy, having 7 heads and 10 horns." So now the woman, this great harlot, is now not sitting on the water, but now she's sitting on this great scarlet beast. The scarlet there, of course, referring to blood, to death, to murder. This beast is one in which has committed great murder and killing individuals. A lot of blood lays upon its head. The beast here, we'll find out a little bit more as we go. If you continue with me in verse 4, he goes on to say, "The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication." You notice here in verse 4, he talks about her gaudy clothing. She is one adorned with much excess. She is filled with excess. She has great wealth, in other words. It's an entity that controls a lot of wealth. He continues in verse 5, and you notice there that on her forehead a name was written. Now notice the name here, mystery. This is a mystery. "Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth." Now we've talked about Babylon earlier in regard to the book of Revelation. Babylon, of course, was a great nation many years ago, many years before this writing. It was the nation that originally took the Israelites into captivity. Babylon did a great many evils. It's called the mother of harlots. It had been seduced by the world and had given in to pleasure and had avoided, went away from God. Had it become an abomination to the earth? So in other words, God was not very fond of Babylon. In thinking about Babylon and this harlot being compared and styled after Babylon, it might make you wonder, when is the first time we hear about Babylon in Scripture? I find this really fascinating and interesting to share with you. Go to Genesis chapter 11 and verse 9, if you will, for just a moment. In Genesis 11, we read about how the people of the earth had gathered all together in one place. Now, that's not what God had asked them to do, but that's what they had decided to do. God had asked them to go throughout the world, to scatter across the face of the earth, to multiply, to fill the earth. And yet here they are all trying to stay in one location. And so they come together and they decide, well, you know what? Let us build a tower to heaven. And so they begin to build this tower. And God sees what they're doing, obviously, and is not very happy. This is not what he called man to do. But in violation of God's will, man had decided he was going to build this tower. Well, God was going to put an end to this violation of his will. And so in verse 9, we're told, therefore its name is called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the earth. So if man was not going to obey God, God was going to accomplish his will another way. The way he does it is by confusing the language. And that's how we've come to know this as the Tower of Babel. Think about Babel today. We use it in a lot of different contexts. With our young children, our babies, our infants. You know, sometimes they're talking away and having a real intense conversation. But we sit back and we're like, I have no idea what you're saying. Sometimes when you're super excited about something, maybe you start talking so fast nobody can understand you, and they're like, you're just babbling. Maybe someone's high on drugs and they start talking and you're trying to figure out what they're saying, and it just coming out as babble. Babble meaning confusion. You may be asking, why share this? What does it have anything to do with Babylon? The same term here for Babel. It's where we get the term Babylon, confusion. Sin brings confusion. Babylon, the harlot, it's all the same. We read a little bit further here in verse 6, we read about we continue to read about this woman, the great Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and the abomination of the earth. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement. That last phrase there is pretty interesting to me. You know, when we often talk about marveling about something, about marveling with amazement, it's usually in a good context. Maybe we're out somewhere, we're tourists, and we see some great side of the earth, some wonder of the earth, and maybe we sit there and we marvel. Or maybe we're watching someone do something that is just unbelievable, and we sit and we marvel at their talent and ability. I don't think that's the way John was marveling at this moment. I think it's not excitement, but horror at the travesties that this entity, this thing, has done. It drank of the blood of the saints. Men had been martyred for their faith at the hands of this evil beast, this evil thing. It had, in its persecution of the saints, drew the ire of God. And that these three ideas make up the nature of this Babylon. Well, we continue reading here in verses 7 through 18. John continues writing, but the angel said to me, why do you marvel? I tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has the seven heads and the ten horns. The beast that you saw was and is not, and will ascend out of the bottomless pit and go to perdition. And those who dwell on the earth will marvel, whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they see the beast that was and is not and yet is. Here's the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. There are also seven kings. Five have fallen, one is, and the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short time. The beast that was and is not is himself also the eighth, and of the seven, and is going to perdition. The ten horns which you saw are ten kings who have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. These are of one mind, and they will give their power and authority to the beast. These will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them. For he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with him are called chosen and faithful. Then he said to me, "The waters which you saw where the harlot sits are peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. And the ten horns which you saw on the beast, these will hate the harlot, make her desolate, naked, eat her flesh, and burn her with fire. For God has put it into their hearts to fulfill his purpose, to be of one mind and, and to give their kingdom to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled. And the woman whom you saw is the great city which reigns over the kings of men." There's some really interesting things here. But in this text, it talks about the beast upon whom Babylon rides, or the great harlot rides. You notice here, he asks the question, "Why do you marvel? Why do you marvel, John?" I'm going to give you an explanation for what you see. And so he proceeds to define some of the things he's talked about. Number one, he talks about the beast which carries the harlot. He says this is the beast from the bottomless pit, but yet will go to perdition. Will be freed for a short time, but then will finally go to perdition. Now, what does that term perdition mean? We've heard of the son of perdition. What does that term mean? Well, the term perdition means destruction. This beast whom is controlling Babylon, who is giving Babylon its power and authority, is the beast we've talked about several times. It is the beast of old. It is Satan. And the point here is, he's reminding John that this beast, no matter how powerful it may seem now, will suffer its destruction. It will be destroyed. Now, the beast may make some men marvel, may make some men believe it is truly powerful, but in the end we'll find that it is not powerful, and that God is more powerful. And he says the seven heads on the beast are the seven mountains upon which the harlot sits. Now, it's interesting, if you look at a map of Rome of the day of John, it was built upon seven hills, indicating for us, I believe, who the woman truly is. It's not a woman. It is not a harlot in the sense of a literal person. It is not Babylon. Babylon has long since been destroyed, but it is Rome. And so he talks about here, this is all about Rome, and he talks about the seven kings, five of which have fallen or died. There is one who now reigns and one who is yet to come. Now, I can't tell you for sure what he means by that. The seven kings could mean all of the kings of Rome, probably referring to that. Let him know some have come and gone, and more will yet come. But there are less in the future than there are in the past. But that their power, their influence has come from the beast, not from God, but it's from the beast. And then he talks about how that the beast will use even other nations to accomplish his will. And they will be given power for a short amount of time, influence for a short amount of time. Kingdoms will come and kingdoms will fall. And they will, by the influence of the evil one, make war with the church. And so Christians will continue to suffer for a short time. But in the end, he reminds them that the Lamb will win this war. That he will overcome, and that he will win the battle. And what I find especially interesting is that in the end, the kingdom of Rome, this empire of Rome, will eat itself. It will be eaten from within and from without, weakened by its own people, by its own kings. And we know that's exactly what happened. Rome was weakened by its kings, eventually weakening it to the point that other nations will destroy it, will take away its power. And we know that the Rome of today is not the Rome of the first century, because that Rome was essentially destroyed. Evil will consume itself. We have seen it time and time again, and for Rome, it will continue that way. And then finally, we look at chapter 18. Read with me, if you will, verses 1 through 3. It says, "After these things, I saw another angel." So another angel comes to give him a vision. Another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority. And the earth was illuminated with his glory. Powerful angel. A powerful messenger of God. Alluding to a powerful message from God. He cried mightily with a loud voice. Again, talking about his might, his influence, his strength, his importance. "Babylon the Great is fallen and has become a dwelling place of demons, a prison for every foul spirit and a cage for every unclean and hated bird. For all nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. The kings of the earth have committed fornication with her. The merchants of the earth have become rich through her abundance." First thing that we notice here is that he announces Babylon's fall, death, her downfall, that Rome will consume itself, will destroy itself. And because of its destruction, the world will feel that loss, because the world has committed fornication, that the world has given in to the influence, to the seduction of evilness that Rome has perpetrated upon it. Kings will have sinned with her and will feel the loss of her, will be harmed themselves because of their affection for Rome, for their blindly going along with Rome. Merchants of the world have become rich. Rome has made many rich. Men are drawn to wealth. Men give themselves up for the love of money, for the love of pleasure. Rome will be for them an example a warning to heed of those who blindly serve self, who blindly serve the material world, and cut themselves off from God. He continues in verse 4. He says here, "And I heard another voice from heaven saying, 'Come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins, lest you receive her plagues, for her sins have reached to heaven. God has remembered her iniquities.'" The call goes out to come out of Rome, to come out of the influence of Rome, to separate yourself from Rome, or you will suffer along with it. Even in the midst of God's coming wrath, He is still calling for those who are willing to be saved to come to Him, to come out of their sins, to repent, to change, to not give in to evil's influence. I'm reminded of Romans chapter 1 and verse 32 in the book we looked at this morning. The book of Romans chapter 1, he is talking about the sins of the Gentiles, and he goes into great detail, Paul here in Romans 1, to talk about and discuss the evil that was going on in Rome. And at the end of that, he talks not only to those who commit such things, but notice what he says to even those who stand idly by and do nothing about it and even approve of it. He says, "Who, knowing the righteous judgment of God, that those who practice such things are deserving of death," those who have committed the acts are deserving of death, "not only do the same, but also approve of those who practice them." Even though some Christians in the first century may not commit those acts, if they go along to get along, they themselves will be guilty of sin. They had to stand out opposed to the evilness of the Roman people, of the Roman government, of the Roman leaders. It would be so easy for Christians of the first century just to go along to get along, to shut up, to act like it's all okay. God reminds them, and He reminds us, to not to allow temptation and sin to lead us into sinning ourselves, but to come out of sin, to come out of its influence, to get away from it. And so that's what he's calling the first century Christians to do. He continues in verse 6. He says, "Render to her just as she rendered to you, and repay her double according to her works. In the cup which she has mixed double for her. In the measure that she glorified herself and lived luxury, in the same measure give her torment and sorrow, for she says in her heart, 'I sit as queen and am no widow, and will not see sorrow. Therefore, her plagues will come in one day, death and mourning and famine. She will be utterly burned with fire, for strong is the Lord who judges her.'" God is a just judge, and God will repay evil. Those who live high on life here in this world, who live for pleasure, for wealth, for the things of the world, cannot buy their forgiveness. As men and women, we have decisions to make. Will we seek after things of the flesh, or will we turn our mind onto things that are spiritual, things that are higher, things that are noble in the eyes of God. So easy to come under the influence of the sinful. We must not allow ourselves to do so. It continues here, 9 through 20. The kings of the earth who committed fornication and lived luxuriously with her will weep and lament for her when they see the smoke of her burning, standing at a distance for fear of her torment, saying, "Alas, alas, that great city Babylon, the mighty city, for in 1 hour your judgment has come." And the merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her, for no one buys their merchandise anymore. Their merchandise in gold and silver, precious stones and pearls, fine linen, purple, silk, scarlet, every kind of citron wood, every kind of object of ivory, every kind of object of most precious wood, bronze, iron, and marble, and cinnamon and incense, fragrant oil and frankincense, wine and oil, fine flour and wheat, cattle and sheep, horses and chariots, and bodies and souls of men. The fruit that your soul longed for has gone from you, and all the things which are rich and splendid have gone from you, and you shall find them no more at all. Those things that men strive for in this life, the things they long for to fulfill their pleasures, are temporary things. They're decaying. They're going to be destroyed along with this world. They will wear away. Moth and rust will destroy. And in the end, what are you left with? The merchants, verse 15, of these things who became rich by her will stand at a distance for fear of her torment, weeping and wailing and saying, "Alas, alas, that great city that was clothed with fine linen, purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls. For in 1 hour such great riches came to nothing. Every shipmaster, all who traveled by ship, sailors, and as many as trade on the sea, stood at a distance and cried out when they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, 'What is like this great city?' They threw dust on their heads and cried out, weeping and wailing, saying, 'Alas, that great city in which all who had ships on the sea became rich by her wealth, for in 1 hour she made desolate. She is made desolate. Rejoice over her, O heaven, and you, O holy apostles and prophets, for God has avenged you on her." You get the picture here that when Rome is destroyed, when God has his vengeance upon her, it will be something that's obvious, something that comes quickly, something that the world can see, something that the world will know has happened. You know, when thinking about Rome and its decadence and it's living luxuriously, I'm drawn to Luke 16. In Luke 16, we read about two men, the rich man and Lazarus. The rich man lived in wealth and you know, lived well, lived luxuriously. And then you had Lazarus, a poor man who sat at the rich man's gates and there begged for food. And that rich man would go by every day and would just ignore this poor man. This poor man who was in deep need. And he would go on living his life as if this man did not exist. He had it well, didn't he? He had all the pleasures you could ask for. He'd been given all of these things. He had time to enjoy them. But then it came time for his death, and he died. And he wakes up and he finds himself in a very different set of circumstances. The roles have been reversed. The rich man now is living in torment, and Lazarus living in ease and in comfort in the bosom of Abraham. And the rich man looks across and he sees Lazarus. And in verse 24, he says, "Father Abraham, have mercy on me." He's in such torment. And he says, "Send Lazarus that he may dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I am tormented in this flame." Even in the midst of torment, he can't get his mind out of someone being a servant for him. He's wanting Lazarus, even in this circumstance, to serve him, to do the thing for him he would not do for Lazarus in his life. Notice Abraham's response in 25 when he said, "Son, remember that in your lifetime you received the good things." And he's got that memory of the good life. But it's now a memory, and it's not a reality any longer. "Likewise, Lazarus, evil things. But now he is comforted, and you are tormented." The point being here is that you need to give some consideration now to how you're living so that you can live better in the next life. To maybe suffer a little torment now in order to live in comfort later. That's not how the rich man lived his life. That's not how Rome lived its life. He goes on here in 20 through 24 as we bring this to a close. He says, verse 21, "Then a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea, saying, 'Thus with violence the great city Babylon shall be thrown down and shall not be found anymore. The sound of harpists, musicians, flutists, trumpeters shall not be heard in you anymore. No craftsman of any craft shall be found in you anymore, and the sound of a millstone shall not be heard in you anymore. The light of a lamp shall not shine in you anymore, and the voice of the bridegroom and bride shall not be heard in you anymore, for your merchants were the great men of the earth. For by your sorcery all the nations were deceived, and in her was found the blood of prophets and saints and of all who were slain on the earth.'" Rome's life will be gone. No longer will she have the amusement of life, of music, of entertainment. No longer will crafts and trades be done within her walls. No longer will they find the joy of marriage. All these things that he's talking about are all joyful occasions, all good things, all pleasurable things. Pleasure will no longer be found in Rome. It will suffer for its great evil. I'm reminded of Hebrews 10:30-31. "For we know him who said, 'Vengeance is mine. I will repay, says the Lord.' And again, 'The Lord will judge his people.' It is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God." Rome fell into the hands of the living God and paid a severe penalty for their evil actions and activities, for the way they persecuted and warred against the church. Today I leave you with this question. The first century Christians had arisen with Christ. They had been buried in baptism so that they could receive that revival of spirit and soul, to have that cleansing of the blood of Christ, so that they could have hope for the coming day of the Lord's return. That's what the book of Revelation is all about. It's about hope. Today, when you consider your life, do you live a hopeful life? I don't mean for the world's goods, for the world's happiness, but do you have an eternal hope? When you die, when you pass on, do you have a hope for that day? Have you risen with Christ? If not, why not tonight? And if you're a child of God who's left your hope, why do you live that way? Why not come back to the only one who can truly provide hope? If you have that need or any need, please come as together we stand and sing.